Our study is in the 32nd chapter of Deuteronomy, and we are in the 15th verse. Verses 15 through 18 are a description of the apostasy of this people of God, which they had a tendency for all the time they were in the land of Canaan, and which ultimately resulted in their utter destruction and being carried into captivity. And we've already discussed many of the features of this 15th verse, but let's notice in a way of brief review. He says, Jeshurun waxed fat and kicked. That is, this word Jeshurun means an upright people or a seeing people. They waxed fat in that they satisfied the gratifications and the sensualities of the flesh. They heaped upon themselves the luxuries of their land, and then they kicked. That is, they rebelled against any effort to correct them or to bring about a repentance on their part. He says in the 15th verse, But Jeshurun waxed fat and kicked. Thou art waxen fat. Thou art grown thick. Thou art covered with fatness. Then he forsook God, which made him and lightly esteemed the rock of his salvation. The real difficult thing here is, and it's true of anybody today, when they turn against God, when they forget God, when they let the pleasures of this life be more important to them than the rock of his salvation, and then when they repel any kind of effort to bring about repentance, when they kick, it's like an oxen that is being trained to pull in the yoke, and he, instead of responding to the goads, he kicks against the goads, and he's rebellious. And it matters not how much tact and kindness and love and consideration you have when you approach a person of this nature. They are going to deeply resent any effort to bring about a correction, to bring about their salvation, to cause them to see the error of their way. That's the attitude Israel had. They had waxed fat and they kicked. They would not allow the prophets to correct them. They would not listen. They esteemed the God of their salvation, the rock of their salvation, lightly, and they forgot about him and forsook him. And so in verse 16 he says, they provoked him to jealousy. Now, the way they did this was with strange gods. They provoked him to jealousy with strange gods. With abominations provoked they him to anger. God considers himself obligated to this people. He's married to this people. He's faithful to them. He wants them to do the same to him. And when they go to other gods, to what he first of all describes here as strange gods, they provoked him to jealousy with strange gods. These are gods that they're not the true and living God. They are not valid gods. They are fake. They are counterfeit. They are no gods. And to worship these things and to follow these things and to be influenced by these things are abominations to God. So they provoked him to jealousy. The word jealousy means that you have a fear of being replaced by something else. And certainly God had a justified feeling of jealousy here because they were replacing him with other gods. And they provoked him to anger with these abominations. God didn't just suddenly get mad for no reason at all, turn his wrath against the people just because he had a feeling that he needed to take it out on somebody. They provoked him. Caused him to do this. It was only a result of their actions that God's anger came upon them. So he mentions then they're turning to idolatry here. And this is the second great way that they fell from God. First of all, they grew fat and kicked. That is, they filled themselves with the sensuality or the sensual pleasures of the land. All the things to satisfy their fleshly desires, and then they turned to idolatry. They forgot about the true God and turned to idolatry. And that happens even to us today. As soon as we forget about God, we have to replace him with something, and we're going to replace him with idolatry. We turn to strange gods. And if we've ever been the true child of God, we're going to provoke him to jealousy and to anger, because these things are an abomination in his sight. Verse 17, they sacrificed unto devils, not to God. to gods whom they knew not, to new gods that newly came up, whom your fathers feared not. Now we see some more characteristics of their turning away from God. He said they sacrificed to devils, not to God. So many of these things that they did, and which we do today, are not just turning to something that's nothing, turning to just stick and stone, but we actually turn to things that are devils. And this word here for devils means destroyers. So that it wasn't just a matter of turning to nothing. They were worshiping forces, powers that were truly the powers of darkness. They were under the influence and the guidance of the devils. Those beings and those spirits that are opposed to God. Not just something out here like worshiping a post that has no feeling at all. These things that they were worshiping were actually described here as devils. That is, they had some kind of power. They had some kind of a spirituality, but it was that was opposed to God. And the temples and the worship and the altars of their sacrifice were things that truly then were not just some neutral nothingness, but it was to devils. So they used strange gods, and they sacrificed to devils, and then he says, to gods whom they knew not, to new gods that came newly up, whom your fathers feared not. Now this is probably one of the worst things that happens to anybody in the spiritual realm, is to have to turn to something that's new, something that has never been heard of before, and put that up in the place of God. And that's one of our greatest tendencies today. We like to take new things. We like to improve upon the things that God has given us so that we have modernized it. And these then take on the characteristics of new gods. Gods whom your fathers feared not. And when we see ourselves in the church today doing things that the original members of the church never heard of, they didn't practice them, there's not anything in the Bible said about doing it, then we have to consider that this very likely is a new God that we turn to. We've got something new, something strange, something our fathers had no fear of, they had no knowledge of, and they did not follow it at all. And this is probably one of the greatest affronts that there is to the true and living God, is to get a new God, a God that has newly come up, one that's just been discovered, just been invented, and we turn to it. It is such an abomination to him. It is such a terrible affront to the true and living God for us to allow this to happen to us. And then he says in verse 18, of that rock that begat thee, thou art unmindful, and hast forgotten God that formed thee. We are unmindful when we turn to these other things. That is, we forget about God. We put God out of our mind, out of our thoughts, out of our activities, and consequently, out of our lives. And you know, it's just really difficult to keep God in our mind and at the same time turn to some other God. Now, that's almost an impossible thing. So anytime we turn to some other God, it has to be interpreted then as a forgetting of the true and living God. We become unmindful of him and have forgotten the God that formed us. And as we said before, one of the most important things we can do in our teaching is to bring about a remembrance of God. This is what Peter wanted to do. It's what Isaiah said that the watchman on the walls would do, is to cause remembrance of God, bring God to remembrance. And if we don't teach his word, if we get up and give speeches that come from man's idea and there are some kind of an outline that man has made and thoughts and ideas that man has, and not really teaching the Bible, not really staying with this thing, book, chapter, and verse, and phrase, and word, then we cause a forgetting of God to occur. Our one job is to cause a remembrance to be made of God. Let's continually remind each other of God and of the things of God. And the treasure store of knowledge is limitless. There's no way we can ever completely ferret out all the things that have to do with God that are revealed to us in the Bible. And so the crowning act of disobedience is described as a forgetting of God and becoming unmindful of Him. Now, as this song of Moses continues, beginning in the 19th verse, we have a record of God's response to their disobedience. This would be verses 19 through 25. So reading verse 19, "And when the Lord saw it, He abhorred them because of the provoking of His sons and of His daughters." Now, this same God who at one time cherished and loved them, treated them as the sons and daughters that He would guide, guard, and protect, now takes on the attitude of abhorring them. They are distasteful to God. They are very displeasing to God. And God has a dislike for them as a result of this. When it goes stronger than the word dislike, it's an abhorring of them. They are very unpleasant to Him. And the reason for this is because of the provoking of His sons and of His daughters. These are not just any other people that God's done little for, that God never had a relationship with. These are His sons and His daughters. And they then have provoked Him. They have tested Him. They have taunted and teased and ridiculed Him. And so because of this provoking, God abhorred them. And truly, there is no irritation as bad as an irritation that would come from one that you truly love. When they turn on you, whenever they provoke you, whenever they replace you with somebody else, then this brings up deep-seated feelings within. Because the deeper the feeling you had before, then the deeper the feeling you're going to have afterwards. And on the part of God, this brought about an abhorrence. Verse 20, "And He said, I will hide My face from them. I will see what their end shall be, for they are a very froward generation, children in whom is no faith." So as a result of this, God was going to hide from them. Instead of being available, being near, listening to their prayers, and giving them the close comfort and guidance and security that God would like to give His people, He's going to hide from them. They're going to look around and not be able to see God. God's not going to be there. God's going to desert them. And consequently, they're going to reap the results of a life in which there is not God. We have people that on every hand, that live a life without God because they choose not to have God. And the way of the sinner, the way of the transgressor is hard. That's a very difficult life to live. And those of us who know the true and living God and who have a relationship with Him that is favorable and acceptable would never want to live a life without Him. We would never want to give up this favored position we have with the Creator, with the Maker of all things. But in the case of these Israelites and these people of God, He was going to hide His face from them. They would not be able to have a relationship with God, not a favorable one. He said, "I will see what their end shall be." That is, all God has to do is to hide from you, to make Himself not available to you, and then He can see your destruction. He can see you go down. He can see your end. And that's what was going to happen in the case of these people. And the reason for this, He says, "For they are a very froward generation." Now, froward generation means that they are hard. They are set in their ways. They are unretrievable. We cannot change them. Nothing that God had done up to this point had brought about a change. He'd sent His prophets. He'd given them their word. He'd given them warnings. He'd made them promises. And nothing changed them. They were very froward people. They were already hardened. They were already set in their ways to the point that there was no turning of them. And He says, "Children in whom is no faith." They did not have faith. They did not have a belief in God. They were not a God-fearing people. No faith. And all these things that He says about those people back during the day that Moses had written this and the few hundred years afterwards, those things still apply today. If we turn against God today, he's going to hide his face from us. If we are a froward generation, if we are children in whom is no faith, then God is going to respond by turning against us and turning away from us. Verse 21, they have moved me to jealousy with that which is not God. Now, here's another description of their sin. They have moved me to jealousy with that which is not God. It wasn't as though they had turned to another true and living God, to another being who had the ability to help them and to form them and to really be their God. But they turned to that which is not God. And as we know, since there is only one God, anytime we turn to anything else then, we've turned to something that is not God. We've turned to a lesser being than the Creator. We've turned to the creature. And when we, who are creatures, serve other creatures, then we have just simply left God out. So they've moved me to jealousy with that which is not God. And it would be well for us to evaluate and to examine all the things that we hold high and to be sure that these things are God and that these things are not things that are not God. Anything other than the true and living God is not God. Anything that is not the truth is simply not the truth. We can't make it half truth or part truth. If it either is the truth or it is not the truth. It either is God or it is not God. And so they've moved me to jealousy with that which is not God. We need to remember that all of our little superstitions, this business, for example, of making a statement and then knocking on wood to be sure that that statement remains to be true, that's appealing to some other force that is not God. It's not God. Any superstition, such as a black cat going across the front of us, is appealing to something that's not God. God's never said anything about that. He's never given us any rules about that. So that's not God. We must not be superstitious. We must not appeal to something that's not God, because this causes God to be moved to jealousy. He says, they have provoked me to anger with their vanities. Now, they've taken things that are worthless, that are useless, that have no value. They're vanities. But yet they put those things in the place of God. They move me to anger with their vanities. Are we doing things that are vain, that have no value, that have no meaning, that have no basis whatsoever in the Word of God for our doing them, but yet we do them, we practice them, we say them? These little superstitions, they don't have to be little superstitions. We can have big superstitions. We can attribute religious significance to things that God never intended to have any significance attached to. We can put things into the worship of God, into the practice of our faith that God never intended to be there. And consequently, then, we are following vanity. We're following our imaginations, things that are worthless, that are useless, that have no value. And when we do this, this moves God to jealousy. This provokes God to anger. And so the result of this is, in the latter part of verse 21, and I will move them to jealousy with those which are not a people. I will provoke them to anger with a foolish nation. Now here God was moved to jealousy. Jealousy means you have a fear that somebody else is replacing you. God was moved to anger. So he was going to in turn then move them to jealousy and to anger. They picked something else for their God which was not God. So he says, I'm going to move them to jealousy with those that are not a people. I'll provoke them to anger with a foolish nation. Now this has, we know of, at least two fulfillments. The first fulfillment, of course, was whenever God would show favor to a nation round about them, and that nation then would be able to move in and to make some kind of a victory over Israel. Any nation that was able to overpower Israel, it meant that God allowed them to do it. God showed them the favor of giving them the power to be able to be victorious. And, of course, the ultimate victory that was shown over them is when they were carried into captivity. Israel, the nation to the north first, and later Judea, the nation to the south. And so he took a people that were not a people. They weren't God's people. They weren't intelligent and learned in spiritual things. They were what he calls here a foolish nation. And so he showed favor to them and allowed them to overpower the Israelites. And consequently then, this would tend to make anybody who had any true perspective on the matter be jealous. Look, God is allowing them to do better than we're doing. He's allowing them to overpower us. He's giving them the victory and giving us the defeat. And so this would move you to jealousy. And he says, I'll provoke them to anger with a foolish nation. A nation that was so foolish, that was not a God-fearing nation, that God had made no promises to. And consequently, he was now showing them favor in the place of his own people. But he was just returning to them what they had done to him. They turned to other gods and provoked him to jealousy and anger with their vanities. And so God now turns to another people, a people that are not truly his people, and provokes them to jealousy and anger with this people that are not a people and with a foolish nation. Now remember, we said that this movement that God made, in which he took another nation and blessed another nation, one that was not a people, one that was a foolish nation, and it provoked the Israelites and the Jewish people to anger and to jealousy themselves, we said this had a second fulfillment. The first fulfillment was, of course, their being carried into captivity and being defeated by the nations round about them. Even some of the Canaanites were able to do this. But the second fulfillment is found in the time of Jesus Christ, in which God actually took the Gentile nation that was not a people. They were a foolish nation. They'd never served the true and living God. He took them under his wing. He gave them his blessings in the place of the Jewish people. And of course, this would have a provoking to jealousy. Now, Paul refers to this in Romans, the 10th chapter, beginning with the 18th verse. He says, but I say, have they not heard? Yea, verily, their sound went into all the earth, and their words unto the ends of the world. But I say, did not Israel know? First Moses saith, I will provoke you to jealousy by them that are no people, and by a foolish nation I will anger you. So he quotes from this passage in Moses, Paul does, to show that Israel had been told that this would happen. Verse 20, but Isaiah is very bold and saith, I was found of them that sought me not. I was made manifest unto them that asked not after me. That's referring to the Gentiles. But to Israel he saith, all day long have I stretched forth my hands to a disobedient and gainsaying people. So that shows us very plainly then that the ultimate fulfillment of this scripture is in the church age today, the Christian age, in which God has taken a people that are no people, the Gentiles, and put them in the place of the Jewish nation and provoked then the Jewish nation to anger and to jealousy. Now in the next verse, the next chapter of Romans, the 11th chapter of Romans, he spends that whole chapter showing how that the Jews, because of disobedience and because of unbelief, were cast away. They were pulled off like the leaves or the branches of an olive tree, and these wild olive branches, the Gentiles, were grafted into their place. But if they will turn to God, then they can be grafted back into their own olive tree like they were originally. And he predicts in that 11th chapter of Romans that they eventually will do that very thing when the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. But at this point, we're not going to take up that much time to give a more thorough explanation of the 11th chapter of Romans. But that's what it's talking about. And so that the ultimate fulfillment of this passage in Deuteronomy about God taking another people, that ultimate fulfillment is today, in the last dispensation, in the church age, by God taking the Gentiles and showing them the favor that he originally should have been showing the Jewish nation. Now this is further described by the same Apostle Paul in Ephesians the 2nd chapter, beginning with the 11th verse. Wherefore you remember that ye being in times past Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision with that which is called the circumcision in the flesh made by hands, that at that time ye were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope, and without God in the world. But now, in Christ Jesus, ye who were sometimes far off are made nigh by the blood of Christ. Then we skip on down to the 19th verse. Now therefore ye are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God, and are built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone. So we see then that ultimately that scripture is fulfilled in the New Testament age, and we today who are followers of the true and living God are made the beneficiaries of this promise. We who were a foolish nation, we who were a people that were not a people, we were not a nation, we were not the children of God, are now able to exercise the privileges of being a people, of being a nation, of being a chosen generation. But remember now, the Jewish nation can come back if they will but restore their faith and believe in the fulfillment of these prophecies, these promises that God made so long ago. Now, beginning in the 22nd verse of Deuteronomy 32, we continue with this song of Moses. He talks about their punishment, what he is going to do as a result of their turning away from him. For a fire is kindled in mine anger, and shall burn unto the lowest hell, and shall consume the earth with her increase, and set on fire the foundations of the mountains. Now God describes his response, his punishment, as a fire. And certainly a fire can wreak all kinds of havoc with anything that it is involved with. A fire is kindled in mine anger. So this anger of God kindled this fire, and this fire was going to have a burning, a consuming quality about it. He said it shall burn under the lowest hell. That is, there's no way to escape it. We think of hell as being the habitation of the dead. And he speaks then here of this fire being able to reach even into that element and being able to burn there. And shall consume the earth with her increase. So everything on the earth that is in the path of this fire can be consumed, and all the increase of the earth can be consumed. He talks about setting on fire the foundations of the mountains, which is probably a reference to his institution here of the church, the people of God, the house of God. And he refers to his people many times as being the holy mountain, the mountain of God. And so this can set on fire the foundation of the mountains. And a lot of this language, of course, is figurative language that we can see how terrible the anger of God can be when he turns it into fire. In the New Testament, even we read of God being a consuming fire. Verse 23, I will heap mischiefs upon them. I will spend mine arrows upon them. Now, this shows there is no escaping from God. And here again, he's using some figurative language. I will heap mischiefs upon them. The things that are bad for us, the things that would constitute a turn of events in the wrong direction, that's what God says he will heap upon those that are disobedient. Not just have an occasional little setback, but he says to heap mischiefs. That is, just thing after thing after thing, so that it just piled up upon you. I will spend mine arrows upon them. God is figuratively here described as shooting arrows at those. Now this arrow that he shoots is going to be sure and straight, and it's going to find its mark. It's going to be deadly. It's going to inflict a grievous and serious wound. It'll come from a hand unseen. It'll come at a time not expected. It'll come with swiftness and in silence, so that by the time we know that it's here, it's already upon us and has already pierced us and done its deadly work. And then in verse 24, he gets more specific now about the punishment that he's going to give them. Verses 24 and 25. He says, they shall be burnt with hunger. Now this means that they're going to be going through a time with not enough to eat. They're going to be hungry. They're going to have a famine of some kind. They'll burn with hunger. And then he says, and devoured with burning heat and bitter destruction. Now this burning heat and bitter destruction could include all kinds of things, like diseases, pestilence, any kind of a discomfort that could cause sickness, illness, failing of the body or mind. And he says they'll be devoured with burning heat and bitter destruction. Then he says, thirdly, I will also send the teeth of beasts upon them and the poison of serpents of the dust, so that the wild animals, the beasts and the serpents, would also turn on them. And they would be bitten by the teeth of beasts and then also smitten with the poison of serpents of the dust. So here God even turns to things that are not other people, to the other creatures that he has created, and uses them against his people. Now just think of it. If God were provoking the wild creatures round about us, the snakes, the scorpions, the wild animals, to turn on us, how much terror this could cause us. We could walk out on the front porch and be bitten by a rabid skunk that was standing there by the door. We could walk out into the yard and be bitten by a poisonous rattlesnake. Or have a spider to bite us at night when we're asleep. All kinds of things like that. And that's what God has promised is going to happen here. And then fourthly, he says in verse 25, the sword. Now this is war. They're going to have another nation to attack them. Not just beasts, not just hunger, not just diseases. But now the other nations are going to attack them. War. He says the sword. The sword without and terror within. Now to have the sword without means that you have an actual open outward conflict. Somebody's attacking you. The sword without. And this brings about, first of all, terror within. Even though you didn't have any wound inflicted upon you, even though you were able to escape, you have this inward terror. Paul talks about, on one occasion, fightings without and fears within. And that's a necessary consequence of a conflict with another person with a deadly weapon. The sword without and terror within. So the least they would have from this conflict of the other nation would be terror within. But then he says, the sword without and terror within shall destroy. So here's death. So the conflict with the other nations brought about fear and death. Terror within and destruction. Fear and death, both. The sword without and terror within shall destroy both the young man and the virgin. It mattered not how strong and how vigorous and how muscular and how able the young men were, they would be destroyed. It mattered not about the beauty and the purity and the enticement of the virgin, also destruction, the young man and the virgin. Then he says, the suckling also with the man of gray hairs, the very young, the baby who was still sucking, and the man of gray hairs. So the strong, the beautiful, the old, and the young, all would be brought into a state of fear and destruction as a result of the sword. So if we look at the punishment God promises them, we see that it is an all-encompassing group of things. Hunger, disease, the teeth of the beast and the poison of serpents, and then the sword, the war with those round about them. In the next few verses, he's going to show that although this people justly deserve to be destroyed, they deserve to be completely annihilated from the memory of men even, that he is not going to completely destroy them. He is going to eventually have mercy upon them. And he explains his reasoning in doing this. Beginning in the 26th verse, I said I would scatter them into corners. I would make the remembrance of them to cease from among men. Now that was what God said he would do. And he said it because he had every right to do this. This people no longer deserve to continue to exist as a people, as a nation. They had forfeited their right to be the sons of God. They had given up the true and living God. And consequently, he had no more obligation to them. And a statement like this would have been a very just statement on his part. That he would scatter them to the corners. That is, he would, no matter how united they were, how closely bonded together they were, he could bring them apart. He could scatter them. He could weaken all power that they may have so that they have no central authority, no central figure at all, nothing to rally around. I would make the remembrance of them to cease from among men. That is, there'd be a nation that was even no longer remembered. He could make this happen. Maybe only in the faint vision that we'd gain through history that we might even know anything about them at all. And I'm sure that he's done this to many other nations. There are nations that have risen and fallen that we know little, if anything, about. And this could have happened with his people Israel, that today there had been no even remnant of Israel. There had been no such thing as a Jew, no such thing as a nation of people like this. It's just something we'd maybe hear about in the pages of history, and that would be it, like some of the nations round about them are today. But he had a reason to not carry this out. And he gives it in verse 27. He says, "Were it not that I feared the wrath of the enemy." This doesn't mean that God actually feared the enemy, but it's the best words that it this could seem to be put into in the King James translation. "Were it not that I feared the wrath of the enemy, lest their adversaries should behave themselves strangely, and lest they should say, 'Our hand is high, and the Lord has not done all this.'" Another translation of this says, "Except that I dreaded the irritation from the enemy, lest their foes should misinterpret it, lest they should say, 'It is our might that has triumphed, and not at all the Lord who did this.'" So you see the reasoning here. God has one eye on how this is going to affect the enemy. Now the enemy constitutes a very large number of people. They are representatives of many nations of people today. And so the kind of an effect that it had upon the enemy was also important to God, because he didn't want them to misinterpret what he really had done. The enemy is going to think that, well, this isn't because their God has done this. This isn't because their God has punished them. This is because we have superior strength. It's because we're just able to overrun this people. So we're something good. We're something great. We have a high hand, and the Lord had nothing to do with this. We could defeat the Lord if we just needed to, because this is his people, and he just didn't protect them, and he couldn't withstand us. It was our doing. And so due to the fact that then was the way the enemy was going to interpret this, God did not completely annihilate his people. And he goes on and says in verse 28, "For they are a nation void of counsel, neither is there any understanding in them." Now some interpret this to mean that he's talking about Israel now. But really it seems to me that the context here is he's talking about these nations that were going to overrun Israel, Babylon, and the group that was attached to that alliance. And they truly were a nation void of counsel. Neither was there any understanding in them. They were idolatrous nations. They gave no heed whatsoever, not even any pretense to recognizing the true and living God. And it seems that here in this verse that God has a feeling for that eventual time way down in the future in which this nation of people, the descendants of this people, are actually going to be his children. They're actually going to take the place of the Israelites. As he has said earlier, he's going to rise up another nation, and he's going to move them to jealousy by another nation that is not a people now. He said, "I will provoke them to anger with a foolish nation." And that's what he's describing now. They're a nation void of understanding, neither is there any counsel, neither is there any understanding in them. And he says in verse 29, oh, that they were wise, that they understood this, that they would consider their latter end. So God even has a feeling for this other people now that are really not his people. He has used them as a tool to bring about punishment on the disobedient nation of Israel and Judah. But this people doesn't understand this. They do not understand that they are simply being manipulated and used by the great and living and all-wise God. And he says, oh, that they were wise, that they understood this, that they would consider their latter end. God has a feeling for them, it seems. And he would like for them to understand his workings and what he's doing, because he eventually has a plan for them to replace this nation of Israel. And it may be a temporary replacement, but that certainly has taken place in the gospel age. And it, according to Romans chapter 11, it is a temporary thing. We're now living in the times of the Gentiles, and whenever that time is fulfilled, then all Israel is going to be saved. But it seems that way back here in this Song of Moses that God is thinking along those lines. In verse 30, he says, how should one chase 1,000 and two put 10,000 to flight, except their rock had sold them and the Lord had shut them up? Now again, some apply this to Israel, as to how Israel could have conquered so many people with such a few number, except their rock, that is, their God, had not allowed this thing to happen. But here again, I believe the context is talking about the time when Babylon and the alliance with Babylon was able to overcome Israel. And what had happened is that God, who had been so great and mighty to cause victories to come right and left to his people, to cause nobody to be able to make any inroads upon them, now then, one could chase 1,000, two could put 10,000 to flight, and the only reason they could do this was because their rock had sold them and the Lord had shut them up. God had allowed it to happen. That's the only reason that they were able to be successful. And if they would just be wise, if they just understand this, they could see then that this was the work of the true and living God and not their own power. That seems to be the context here. If this people were wise, if they had any understanding, if they had any true counsel about them, they could see what had been happening in the course of history. They could see that the only way that they could overcome this people, this nation of Judea, and of Israel, the only way they could be victorious over them was simply for their God to no longer continue to assist them, for their God to sell them and the Lord to shut them up. For the successes and the victories and the invincibility of this nation depended directly upon the blessings of their God. And he says in verse 31, for their rock is not as our rock, even our enemies themselves being judges. These people knew that the gods they followed weren't like this true and living God. They were judges of that themselves. They could determine that just by observation. And they had admitted that this true and living God was certainly a God that was superior to their God. And they recognized this. And if they just had the proper wisdom and understanding, then they could use this knowledge to lead them to the true and living God.